So Newton's first law of thermodynamics says this, that an object will remain at rest or in a uniform motion in a straight line unless acted upon by an external force. That things at rest stay at rest, and things in motion stay in motion unless acted upon by some outside force. And one unbelievable sort of awesome example of this is roller coasters. As you see here, this is actually the top thrill dragster at Cedar Point. This is at the time when I rode it, it was the tallest and fastest roller coaster in the world. And it's a different sort of roller coaster than other ones because, you know, as I said, things at rest tend to stay at rest and things in motion stay at motion. And generally what happens in roller coasters is you start out at a slight incline, and once they release the brakes, you kind of roll forward slowly and you hit that first hill, and then the click, click, click of anticipation as you're pulled up that first hill. And then gravity is the force that acts upon the cart, and then you go through the loops and the hills. But this one is different. This one, you're perfectly still, and you can't feel it, but there's pressure building up in the car. And so when you start motion, you start at top speed. It takes off, like all the speed you're going to have, it takes off at the very beginning. Like it's like there's pressure building, and then woof, and then you go up this big hill, perfectly straight up, and then over, and then down again, and it kind of corkscrews down. And so when I went on this roller coaster, like you're sitting there, and there's like a red light, and then a yellow light, and then a green light, and then it launches you, and you go from like zero to full speed and momentarily. And at that point, it was the fastest roller coaster on the planet. And so I went on it once, and then we were talking and talking. I brought a group of students there because I was a youth pastor in Cincinnati at the time. And I had some parents there with me, and one of the moms, I had been working on her all day. Man, come on, go on Top Thrill Dragster with me. She's like, nope, 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 not doing it, not doing it. I was like, come on, come on, come on, come on, Donna. Come on, Donna. Top Thrill, come on. And so finally, we went on Top Thrill Dragster, but she actually went in line. She went on the car in front of me, so we didn't go on the same one. And as I convinced Donna to go on Top Thrill Dragster, what I didn't say is that every so often when it builds up pressure and momentum, it doesn't build up quite enough to make it over the first hill. So then it comes back down backwards the hill and then launches again. And so you can see where the story ends. Donna's cart, the one in front of me, didn't quite make it up over the hill. And so then she had to, just like, whew, and it comes over, and it kind of stops, and then it starts going backwards, and all of us back and waiting in the little, like, for the next car, we're like cheering, because we know that means Donna is, you know, coming back down backwards, has to launch again. She comes back down, and she's like to me, he's like, I'm going to kill you, you made me do it. It's this beautiful story of like it's momentum. It's like things in motion tend to stay in motion unless acted upon by an outside force. And for Donna, unfortunately, the outside force was gravity, right? And this happens, though, in people's lives, too, though, that things in motion stay in motion and things at rest stay at rest. How often have you seen people make a mistake and have that momentum, that motion stay in motion? How often have you seen someone who maybe just wasn't working hard or succeeding at life, or and they just sort of like stayed in this failure to launch sort of because there was this motion and they stayed in this motion. And people intend to work hard and try and get ahead in life, and that's sort of like a momentum that people tend to stay in until acted upon by an outside force. And you see people, and they make mistakes, and these mistakes have a tendency to build on and build on and build on to one another. And in a way that, you know, the first mistake would have been bad enough, but they make things worse because things in motion tend to stay in motion. And it happens, like, you know, in small ways, like with kids. You know, every now and then you'll see a kid, and the mom will say, don't get the cookies out of the cookie jar. And the kid will instantly, what will the kid do? They'll get the cookies out of the cookie jar. And what happens is the mom says, little Johnny, you and I are the only ones here. And there were cookies in the cookie jar, and now there are no cookies in the cookie jar, and I know I didn't eat those cookies, so where did the cookies go? Johnny says, I have no idea, Mom. I don't know. But you know what I'll do for you, Mom? I believe it's, you know, outside influence at play here, and I will supervise the investigation for you, Mom, if you want to figure out what happened to the cookies in the cookie jar. And the mom's like, well, it's funny because normally when someone eats cookies, there's crumbs they leave behind. And Johnny's like, oh, I didn't know that. That's funny. I didn't know that. But I'll look for those in my investigation. The mom's like, because it's funny because you, Johnny, have cookie crumbs around your mouth. And then it's like, oh, okay, mom, finally you got me. I'm busted. And what does the mom say? If you had just told me the truth on the front end, this wouldn't have been as bad. But you made matters worse. And that's a child with a child-sized problem. But adults have the same thing. But when adults have problems, when adults make mistakes, when adults make mistakes in ways that have emotion that tend to stay in motion, it's not a child-sized problem, it's an adult-sized problem, and it's oftentimes that adult's life imploding. And when adult's life implodes, it can implode not just in that moment, but it can implode in ways and on levels and in for their entire life and then beyond that life. Like if things in motion stay in motion and a life imploding tends to stay imploding, then what can happen is there can be generations of imploding that happen. How often have you seen unhealth happen in someone's life and they pass this unhealth on to their kids, and it's the kids' job to either deal with this unhealth or they begin to pass that unhealth on. Like it either has to be dealt with or that unhealth goes generation to generation to generation. And sometimes that unhealth isn't the exact same unhealth that gets passed on. Sometimes it's the equal and opposite unhealth. Maybe there's a parent who is overly controlling. And so what does the kid do? Maybe their kid, when they become the parent, becomes overly free. You know, they give too much freedoms to their children. So maybe sometimes there's a parent and there's some addiction or overuse of alcohol or drugs, and there's chaos in the home. And so what does that child do when they become the parent? They control, they are fear, there's afraid, and it's passing on. These things in motion tend to stay in motion. You know, Exodus 25 says it this way. I lay the sins of the parents upon the children. The entire family is affected, even children in the third and fourth generation of those who reject me. And the thing is, like, this sounds very ungodlike at first, because you think of God as this loving God, this God that's between you and him, and there's grace and there's forgiveness. But then you see something like this, and you're like, man, if you go into a cold sweat, I don't blame you, because your parents, like mine, are imperfect. And so you think of, man, if there's unhealth, and that can get passed on to generation, to generation, to generation. And what you see happening in the story of David today is a man who makes an unbelievably awful, violent, destructive choice. And that unbelievably awful, violent, destructive choice is going to get played on not just to the rest of his life, but then to his children's life and his children's children's life. And the destruction, the life implosion that happened, it stayed imploding until the consequences were huge. And what you have is you have, there's two people who are most often a corresponding names to Davids. The first one is David and Goliath, right? You have David and Goliath. And Goliath was this large man, this powerful man, this vindictive and manipulative, violent, destructive man. And David was a man of action, and David stood up against Goliath. And we love the story of David and Goliath, the little guy versus the big guy, the underdog versus the champion. But the other name that's most often corresponded with David's is David and Bathsheba. And the irony of David and Bathsheba is that David is the large man. He's the mighty man. David is the man of influence. David is the man who in this story is violent and vindictive and murderous and manipulative. And so David becomes the Goliath of this story. This story is ugly. I know that John warned you. This story is ugly. It's David being destructive. It's David's life imploding and that motion staying in motion and him making matters worse and things getting worse and worse and worse. And it goes on for so long that it impacts generations and thousands of lives. So we're going to start reading in 2 Samuel 11. And in 2 Samuel 11, verse 1, it says this. In the spring of the year, when kings normally go out to war, David sent Joab and the Israelite army to fight the Ammonites. They destroyed the Ammonite army and laid siege to the city of Rabbah. However, David stayed behind in Jerusalem. So this is the time of year when the ground thaws and the chariots don't sink into the mud, and it says that the kings normally go out to war. And this happens because different, you know, cities and city kingdoms and territories, they'll push against the boundaries and they'll try and take the next town over into the other kingdom, and they will pillage and they will destroy and they will burn and they will take that ground. And so the king has to respond of this town and defend his people and his territory. And this happens in the spring. And this is and what happens here is that David doesn't go. So that David sent Joab, the commander of his army, to fight the Ammonites. Actually, those last couple words, David stayed behind in Jerusalem. In the original language, it says that David sat in Jerusalem. And what you see here is a man who, so he's probably around 50 at this time. He's been king for a little while, maybe 20 years. And David, 50 is not an old man here now today, but that's at or exceeding life expectancy at that time. And so David, to them, is an old man. David, at this point, knows that his greatest battles are behind him. His grandest, most glorious days, the days that poets will write poems about, and the days that the singer of songs will sing about, they're all in his past. He is restless. And David sat in Jerusalem. The thing about this is, when you look at when you step back from this story and you look at David's life, David is two things all the time. David is a man of action, and David is a passionate man. Like when Goliath came and challenged the army and God, David was a man of passion and a man of action. When David is writing these worship songs we call Psalms, David is a man of action and a man of passion. And in this moment, David is neither. He is neither a man of passion or action. And really, at this point in the story, what you have to realize is that this should have been a warning light in the dashboard of David's soul. Like, David should have looked at the dashboard of his soul and had seen the engine light beeping at him and blinking at him. And he should have been like, man, something is off with me. I am at my best when I am worshipful, when I am passionate, when I'm a man of action. But instead, I'm sitting in Jerusalem. I think this is going to turn into a cautionary tale. For lives imploding tend to stay imploding until acted upon by an outside force. But the first thing you have to see is that before things get to the level of implosion, I believe generally you sense something. Like in your soul, on the dashboard of your soul, you see the engine light blinking. Something is wrong. I'm not myself. Something's going on. I should seek counsel. I should pray with someone. I should figure out what's wrong in my soul. But David didn't. He didn't see that. In verse 2, late one afternoon, after his midday rest. Great, so he's the head of a state, and late in the afternoon, after his midday rest, that's a good start, David. David got out of bed, oh, good for you, and was walking on the roof of the palace. As he looked out over the city, he noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. He sent someone to find out who she was, and he was told she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Now, a couple of details here. Number one, she's a woman of unusual beauty. Her name is Bathsheba. She's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Now, Uriah the Hittite would have been one of David's closest confidants. Every detail we can find of Uriah the Hittite indicates that he was a man of honor, a man of loyalty, a man who served David and the country well. A man of honor and loyalty. And everything you can see about Bathsheba, every detail in this story lets you know that she is a woman of honor. She's a woman of character. She's a woman who lived by and lived in the culture and operated observing the faith to the best she could. Woman of honor and a woman of loyalty. And this is who he sees. He sees the wife of one of his closest confidants, and she is bathing. In verse 4, then David sent messengers to get her. And when she came to the palace, he slept with her. She had just completed the purification rites after having her menstrual period. Then she returned home. Now, there are a couple details here that I'm going to get into. The first one sounds like a detail in minutia, but it's very, very important. And it's that she had just completed the purification rites after her menstrual period. Now, this sounds like some sort of like weird detail, but it's significant because there's all these rules and restrictions and guidelines around how someone would go about doing that, how someone would go about completing the purification rites after having their menstrual period. There's places they have to be, there are situations and times that they have to happen so that they can be considered culturally faith clean again and enter community. And I would say 3/4 of the time that I've read stories or books or commentaries or listened to other sermons about this story, about 3/4 of the time, it boils down to something like, this is a story about two people in the wrong place at the wrong time. David should have been out to war and Bathsheba shouldn't have been where she was. That she was taken to the palace and she, by the way, there's one little phrase here that in this translation, it doesn't really carry. And in chapter 11, it says that David sent for her. When she got to the palace, he laid with her. But actually, in the original language, it says that he took her and laid with her. This is not a choice that she made. She had no ability to tell the king no. And it wasn't this thing where she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. She shouldn't have been bathing where he could have seen. Because when you are going through this sort of ritual, you have to do this action in this one place at this wrong time. There is... And oftentimes what you have in commentaries is, well, she shouldn't have been where she was. She was asking for it. You know, she shouldn't have been bathing in that place because if she wasn't bathing there, then she wouldn't have been tempting David and David fell. And so there are two people in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's not what this is. This is not what it is. She had no choice about the action. She had no choice about the time of the action. She had no choice about the location of the action. And when he saw her and he took her, she had no choice in that matter either. This is David with an act of sexual assault and sexual violence against her. This is a person who had her power taken from her. And if this sounds like the Me Too movement, it's because it should, because it's the exact same thing. This is not two people in the wrong place at the wrong time. We're not going to victim blame here today. This is David making destructive choices. This is David who the warning light in his dashboard of his soul should have been going off, but it wasn't. David was in the wrong place. His soul was in the wrong place. He was not a man of action and passion and worship of God. He was a man sitting in Jerusalem, and he took this action and this passion, and he aimed it in the wrong place at his friend and confidant's wife. And what you have in verse 5, later, when Bathsheba discovered that she was pregnant, she sent David a message saying, her only two words in the entire Bible, I'm pregnant. This is not someone who made a choice. You can't tell the king no. This is someone who had actions acted upon her. These are her only two words in the story. You know, at the end of this tale, at the end of this cautionary tale, this sordid tale of destruction, what you're going to have is David's going to write Psalm 51. And Psalm 51 is this beautiful psalm. It's this psalm of recognition where he recognizes what he did. It's this psalm of confession that what he did was terrible, abhorrent. It's this psalm of him submitting to God and him being changed and molded by God. And then he is, recognition, it's confession, it's submission, and then there's restoration. And it says that David says, restore to me the joy of my salvation. And so he is restored by God. And this would have been an amazing time for this to happen. Oh my goodness, I shouldn't have done this. I took this woman against her will. It was an act of sexual assault and violence. And how did I get here, God? Have mercy on me. But he didn't write Psalm 51 now. And when he realized that she was pregnant, it would have been an amazing time for him to write Psalm 51. But he didn't write Psalm 51 then. He kept going because things in motion tend to stay in motion, and lives imploding tend to stay imploding. And so what David did is he called for Uriah to come back from the front lines. And his plan was to have Uriah spend the night with his wife in honor of his service, to come back and have the comforts of home. And then Uriah will think it's his child all along. And so he brought Uriah home, but Uriah's like, my men are out there fighting. They're out there losing their lives and bleeding on the battle for me, and I can't come home. So instead of going home to his wife, Uriah slept on the front steps of David's palace, and just in case he could defend David from any threat, foreign or domestic. So Uriah never went home. So the next day, David's like, oh my goodness. He never went home. So he threw a party in Uriah's honor. He got Uriah drunk. And he aimed Uriah drunk towards his home and said, Uriah, now that you're drunk, go home. And Uriah fell asleep on David's couch, as you do when you had too much to drink. I've heard, I don't know. And I read that in a book somewhere. And this isn't an amazing time for David to write Psalm 51, but he doesn't. What he does is he knows that Uriah is a man of honor. And so he puts a letter into Uriah's hand that says, when the battle is raging at its most intense, what I want you to do, he sends it to Joab, the commander of his army. I want you to do is I want you to pull back your army, but don't tell Uriah you're doing this so that everyone around him will pull back except for Uriah, and Uriah will die in battle. And he puts this letter in Uriah's hands. And Uriah doesn't read the letter. He delivers it to Joab. And Joab reads it and looks up at him. And reads it and looks up at him. And you can't tell the king no, so he says, okay. And so when the battle was raging, he sent the command to pull back. But the plan didn't go so well. And Uriah died, but so did all of the men that served Uriah. Lots of men. We don't know how many, a battalion, a few hundred men, we don't know. They died. And this would have been an amazing time for David to realize what he had done and to write Psalm 51, but he didn't. He didn't. And then 1 Samuel 11:26 says this, when Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. When the period of mourning was over, David sent for her and brought her to the palace, and she became one of his wives. I wonder, who do you think determined how long the mourning period would be? Her or David? Because you can't tell the king no. And she became one of his wives. Oh, goody, the man who took me against my will, act of sexual violence and assault. The man who had my husband killed, the man who has lied and deceived and manipulated ever since. Now I get to live with him. That's fantastic. And this would have been a great time for David to write Psalm 51, but he did not. The first verse of the next chapter says this. So the Lord sent Nathan. Now Nathan was the prophet of God, and Nathan was going to come and tell David what David had done was destructive and violent and manipulative and murderous and disrespectful. And David would finally listen. And David would finally write Psalm 51. But do you see how things in motion tend to stay in motion and lives imploding tend to stay imploding, and that along the way, before the implosion starts, there's an opportunity to say, something's off in my soul. God, what is going on? Step into my life and direct things. And once the implosion starts happening, there's step after step after step. It doesn't have to get all the way there. Eventually, God will do what it takes. He loves you too much to allow you your life to keep imploding. He will get your attention eventually. He will send a Nathan or something like it to shake you from the implosion. But what you don't see in this story is the consequences that played out, not just in David's life, in Bathsheba's life, in Uriah's life, but generationally. What you have is David's children, decades later, acts of sexual assault and violence on powerless women. There are moments when David's children are murdering and deceiving. It was one of David's children literally has hundreds of wives. And what you see is this thing play out, not just in David's life and Bathsheba's life, but generationally, like Exodus 25 warns. And it's jarring and it's terrifying. This is when you realize how broken David's hallelujah was. You know, Oswald Chambers, the author of My Utmost Force Highest, says this: an unguarded strength is ultimately a double weakness. And this action and passion that David lived with, this is his strength. This is the thing that drove David. This is the thing that made David, David. But this action and this passion is the exact same platform which became his undoing, his implosion. It was ultimately his double weakness. And so what you have is you have David, and he eventually writes Psalm 51. And as you look at Psalm 51, it's hopeful, it's gracious, it's merciful. It's what you have come to expect from God if you've walked for him with him for any amount of time. But in Psalm 51, it says this. You know, it starts out with this recognition. Have mercy on me, O God, because of your unfailing love, in verse 1. Because of your great compassion. Blot out the stain of my sins. Wash me clean from my guilt. Purify me from my sin. For I recognize my rebellion. It haunts me day and night. And it starts out with this recognition. It starts out with a recognition that what you've done is destructive, and it was violent, it was manipulative. And so this is where David is at. He's recognizing what he had done. The thing about poor choices, destructive choices, an imploding life, sin, is that it comes prepackaged with consequences. You can't get one without the other. And so yes, David is now recognizing, but he allowed this thing to go on and on and on, so that so much so that this thing got momentum, and this thing in motion tended to stay in motion. And if he had recognized this thing earlier, I think the longer something like this goes on, the more devastating it becomes. And the earlier you recognize what's about to happen, the less impact it has on your life and the life of those people around you. And so the first step in something like this, it's always to recognize, and recognize early and take care of it. The first thing in Psalm 51, the passage he eventually writes, is to recognition. And then it's confession. He says, I have done what is evil in your sight. He's confessing to God. He's saying, to you, and you alone, I have done wrong. I have done wrong in your sight. He is confessing to God. He's saying, God, I have been broken. I've been flawed. I've done these terrible, abhorrent things. I must confess that to you. So it's recognition, and it's confession, and then it's submission. What you see happening and playing out in Psalm 51, verses 7 and 10, is that he then begins to talk about what God is doing for him and through him in his life. And these actions that are being taken, they're not his actions, but they're God acting upon him. And it is his job in this moment not to pull himself up by his bootstraps or to make himself better, but God acting upon him will do these four specific things. In 7 and 10, it says this. It says, purify me from my sins, and I will be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. And in 10, it says, create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a loyal spirit within me. What you have is a man whose life imploded. And all too late, there was a recognition of what happened. There was a confession of what he had done. And eventually he submitted to God and allowed God to do these things, to purify and to clean and to create and to renew. And this is what happens in your life and mine. This is what Jesus does through the work of the Holy Spirit. If the beacon on your dashboard's been going off for a very long time and your life is imploding, you're making these destructive choices, and you feel powerless, honestly, you feel in that moment like what's going on is bigger than you and you could never respond to it. That's because it is, and you could never respond to it. You have to recognize what's happening. There's a confession to God of what is happening and that you need him, and that he comes in, he renews, he restores, he cleans. And your job there, submission. God, you move on my behalf. You change me. You shape me. You mold me. It's like in the Bible when God is called like a potter, where he's molding and he's shaping and we are the clay. The act is done to us. Our role is to submit to him. And then if there is recognition and there's confession and there's submission, in verse 12, it says this. It says, restore to me the joy of your salvation. After recognition and confession and submission, there's restoration. This is the nature of God. If you've spent any time with God, you've experienced this probably time and time again, is that there is mistakes made, there's life imploding, but the life is not defined by that implosion. It just is until you recognize and you confess and you submit, and then God will restore. And I read this verse earlier, which is terrifying, which can cause you to break out into a cold sweat, which is Exodus 25. Let me read this again. It says this. In Exodus 25, I lay the sins of the parents upon their children. The entire family is affected, even children to the third and fourth generations of those who reject me. And I've talked about how God is this God of restoration, and that God is this God who will look at you and who will restore you. Yes, the consequences are there. The consequences come prepackaged with the choices, but he will come alongside you. He will love you, and he will restore you. But you're like, yeah, but what about this thing about what my parents do? Like, it can impact me to third and fourth generation. You look at the next verse. But I lavish, so he says, if I will lay the sins of the parents upon the third and fourth generations, but I, God, will lavish unfailing love for 1,000 generations on those who love me and obey my commands. Like, oh, that's the God I'm familiar with. So if this is you, if you look at your life, you say somehow along the way the light on the dashboard of my soul, it was saying engine error, and I just kept right along. Like David was a man of action and passion, but he sat in Jerusalem. And if that's where you're at today, headed off at the pass today. Recognition, confession, and submission. But if you're someone whose life has been imploding for some time, if it has been off in some way, if when you look at your life, there is something devastatingly off about it, and maybe it hasn't gotten to the place where your life is imploding, or maybe it just started imploding, or maybe your life has been imploding for some time, I don't know. But if it's off in some way, these things have a way of staying in motion, because things in motion stay in motion unless acted upon by an outside force. And that outside force today might be the work of the Holy Spirit calling you to better. You recognizing that today and confessing and submitting to God. This David and Bathsheba tale, it's a dramatic one, but it's a cautionary one. Eventually, he wrote Psalm 51, but it had gone on for so long that the consequences were devastating for him and for generations. It doesn't have to go on that long. So if there's something going on in your heart, if there's something going on in your soul and in your life, today is a day that is acted upon by an outside force. You know, after the service is over, there'll be people down front here who would love to pray with you. You can tell them details or none. You can walk them through what's been going on in your life, or you don't. You can just say, I just need someone to pray with me. I need prayer to be that outside force. And there'll be people here to pray for you. I'll be kicking around up front here, and if you need someone to pray with you, I can direct you to someone. But don't let this thing get momentum. Don't let the light on the dashboard of your soul keep going off. Don't let a life imploding stay imploding like David did. But recognize, confess, and be restored. Let's pray. God, this is tough. Because it's tough because of the subject matter, and it's tough because it's people who we've come to admire and like and look up to in your word, this King David doing abhorrent things. And it's tough because it's very real to life. Like, we see things going on in our soul, these warning lights. We've probably seen, God, generational unhealth happen. Maybe we've seen generational unhealth in our own families. Maybe it's time for us to recognize and to confess, to submit and be restored. God, let us not get to the end of the tale before we write Psalm 51. Let us write Psalm 51 when the warning light goes off. Let your grace hit us in that moment there. God, I am beyond grateful that Exodus 20 doesn't stop at verse 5, but it goes on to 26. That yes, it's not a threat, it's a warning. You know, when we live destructive lives, of course our kids' lives are impacted. But when we live lives marked by you, you will bless us and our children and our children's children for it.
So God, it's tough. It's a tough morning. It feels dreary inside as it is outside. But it's also a moment of grace. You promise there's nothing we can do that can make you love us less, and you can always restore us into a loving relationship with you. So there are people here today, God, who feel like their life has been imploding too long, that you could not reach them. Show them they are wrong. There's no extent to your love. If the warning light is going off in the dashboard of their soul, stop them now. And if their lives imploding, let's start the action today of restoration. God, we love you and we thank you. In your name, amen.